Benjamin Folloy was the first military aviator. He learned to fly from the Wright brothers, and he's one of the most important but least remembered U.S. military aviation pioneers. Today, I'm joined by U.S. Air Force Brigadier General Matteo Martamucci to talk about the life of Benny Folloy and the legacy of innovation he left for airmen today. This is the Air Minded Podcast. Welcome back, Air Minded listeners. This is the Air Minded Gorilla, Tyson Wetzel. Back after a little bit of a hiatus. Sorry I haven't been able to get episodes out for the last few weeks. As I mentioned in the prologue episode, I do have a day job. I'm the commander of a 440-member U.S. Air Force squadron, and that can sometimes keep me pretty busy, and I've been overcome by events the last few weeks. But not to fear, I am back to recording some content, and we should have some episodes coming out back-to-back for the next few weeks. My guest today I'm really excited about, Brigadier General Matteo Martamucci. He is the Director of Intelligence for U.S. Cyber Command. General Martamucci is passionate about air power history. He is air-minded. He's also passionate about innovation, and these interests intersect in the form of General Benjamin Benny Folloy, who probably not many of you know, but I consider to be the most underappreciated military aviation pioneer. Folloy's list of military aviation firsts is impressive. He took delivery of the Army's first heavier-than-air craft, a Wright Flyer known as Signal Corps No. 1. He was the Army's first military aviator. At one point, he was the entirety of the United States Air Force. He invented the first safety belt for aircraft. He conducted the first military reconnaissance flight. He was the first commander to lead U.S. Air Forces into conflict, as he was the commander of the first Aero Squadron in the punitive expedition to capture Pancho Villa in 1916. He eventually became chief of the air service for the American Expeditionary Forces in World War I in France. In 1931, he ascended to the top spot, becoming the chief of the Air Corps, a position he held until 1935 when he retired. After his retirement, he remained a passionate advocate for air power. In 1968, shortly after he passed away, his memoirs, From the Wright Brothers to the Astronauts, was published. And we're going to talk about this book a lot today, and I think it is pretty fantastic. And since a lot of people don't know about Folloy, they are more familiar with people like Hap Arnold or Billy Mitchell. Reading the role that Folloy played and being there at all the critical initial events in U.S. Army, what eventually became U.S. Air Force history, is a really key part of air power history that is kind of not well understood. So I don't believe there is a bigger Folloyophile, to make up a word, in the United States Air Force than General Martamucci. He speaks passionately about Folloy and Folloy's legacy of innovation that he leaves for us today. General Martamucci sees parallels between the era of air power innovation that occurred during Folloy's time and the same type of era of innovation that is occurring right now in the cyberspace domain. General Martamucci in this interview is engaging, he's inspiring, and I think you are going to enjoy the interview just as much as I did, and I think that many of you are going to want to pick up a copy of this book if you can find it. Good luck, it's being more and more difficult to find. So without further ado, let me get to the interview with Brigadier General Matteo Martamucci. All right, my guest today is U.S. Air Force Brigadier General Matteo Martamucci, the Director for Intelligence for U.S. Cyber Command, a Penn State alum, my second Penn State alum that I've had on the podcast, a career intel officer who's commanded at the squadron group and wing level, a graduate of Air Command and Staff College, a joint advanced warfighting school at the National Defense University, and a National Security Affairs Fellow at Stanford, at the Hoover Institute at Stanford, which I'm going to have to ask you about. It's kind of my dream school. We could talk intelligence and cyber all pod, and maybe sometime I'll have you on to talk about intelligence and cyber. But I asked you on here today to talk about one of the Air Force's pioneers and the first ever military aviator, General Benjamin Benny Folloy. First off, sir, welcome and thank you for coming.
Hey, thanks, Gorilla. I really appreciate the opportunity.
All right. So I was just telling you before we got started, at some point in the last few years, you recommended his 1968 autobiography, From the Wright Brothers to the Astronauts, to my wife, Amanda. So she got the book and then I read it. And you're kind of the only Air Force officer I know that is pushing Benny Folloy. And I'm not sure I knew about him before I read this book. So that was the big reason why I wanted to have you on to talk about an air power pioneer that I don't think we spend enough time on. Okay, so let me start with my kind of general questions. What's your Air Force origin story?
Okay, so to do this briefly, my origin story started very young. As a young kid, I had the great fortune of actually being a first-generation American. English is not my first language. Many people would be surprised to find out. My mother, who escaped communist-controlled Czechoslovakia in 1965, spoke only Czech in the home, and that was my first language. And after immigrating to the United States and getting that magic blue American passport that accompanied the citizenship, she felt emboldened to go back and visit with us in tow. And so my first most formative memories and experiences with systems other than our own was as a young kid in visiting then Czechoslovakia in the Cold War, and my eyes as a 12-year-old being opened to the fact that we have it really damn good, and that other places in the world lived far differently than we. And I realized at the time, man, this isn't right. People here are not living well, and this really can't stand. And so that was burned into my memory as a young child. And then kind of a classic story, high school junior ROTC, fascinated by airplanes and everything aviation, fell into this love of being part of something larger than myself, excited to be in an organization like junior ROTC. That translated into ROTC in college at Penn State, as you mentioned. The rest is history. So just kind of a combination of wanting to be part of something that was doing good in the world, recognizing that we had it really good, and then this love of aviation and flying and everything to do with the Air Force is what got me started on this journey.
Did you know it was going to be a career, or is it just kind of kept going as it was interesting and doing good jobs and kept going, or was this kind of the plan leaving Penn State?
No, I would love to say that I had a grand plan, but it was certainly not. It was, initially, let's see what happens kind of a thing. But every assignment was better than the last, and every experience was new and exciting. And it very quickly, without even thinking about it, turned into a career. And I'm still not sure what I want to do when this crazy ride is over, but it's still fun, and that's why I keep doing it.
Well, I do have to give you a thank you, as this is my public forum, as the hiring authority that actually hired me to my squadron command. Thank you. It's been a crazy ride. I wish you would have picked a time where it wasn't a global pandemic, but I'm sure even you couldn't have imagined that. So I'm noticing you're talking about being an air power kind of junkie or aficionado. I think over your left shoulder, I see Chuck Yeager in front of the glamorous Glennis. And then I also think I see the Wright Flyer. So don't know if you trotted those out for me today, or that is always in the office.
So that Chuck Yeager, which is signed by him to me, and I have another in my work office, have been there for a very, very long time. In fact, I had the great honor of not only meeting him, but spending several quality years with him while I was at Edwards Air Force Base in my first assignment. And I know you had Fokker, Dini, and others on talking about Chuck Yeager, and I smiled listening to that podcast because I have similar stories. Having met him as a young high schooler, and then just incredible for a young aviation nerd to be stationed in his first assignment there at Edwards when then retired General Yeager was still on flying status as a consultant to the Air Force and would regularly swing by Building 1 where I worked. And many, many afternoons sitting there listening to him tell stories. And he, in fact, promoted me to first lieutenant, which was one of the honors of my very young career at the time.
Wow, I had no idea. I would have dumped Fokker Dini had I known these stories. well, that's awesome. I do know that you are that you've got a drink in front of you. What do you have today?
Yeah, so I definitely did a little IPOE on this, and I am prepared. And what I'm drinking this evening is a Zacapa 23, and I did that. Whoa. Nice little sipping rum, and I did it in honor of Benny's Spanish-American War Puerto Rican campaigns. I went the rum theme since that's where Benny started his military adventure.
I could have seen maybe tequila in reference to the to the Pancho Villa, the hunt for Pancho Villa, but I love it.
Me and tequila parted ways a long time ago after some not so good 21st birthday experiences.
I'm sure another good Penn State story. Okay, so we talked about your individual origin story. I'd love to hear the Benjamin Benny Folloy origin story, not his origin story, but your interest in him, as he's incredibly important to the Air Force that we'll get into, but he's not very well known. When did your interest in him begin?
Yeah, so you're exactly right. He's not. When you look at the sort of, the hallowed halls of our founding fathers and those we study, he is definitely not among the top. And so I stumbled on him, to be honest. I'm not a historian by any means, but I read. And I happened to be reading about some of the early aviation pioneering work when I was in command of the 318th Cyber Ops Group down in San Antonio. And I happened to have read a few snippets about Benny Folloy, and the parallel started to hit me because at the time I was in command, like I said, of the 318, and there were a handful of captains and tech sergeants who were doing some really amazing things, and they still are, I'm sure, in the arena of cyberspace operations when it was, and it still is, kind of uncharted territory, didn't have a lot of direction, and they were just jamming away on some amazing tactics, techniques, and procedures, and they were building things. And I started reading about what Benny Folloy had done in these very early days of airmanship, and I thought, my God, these parallels are so striking. Just 100 and then maybe 106, 107 years later, my airmen are doing exactly the same thing, just in a slightly different domain. And so I started digging, and I stumbled on his autobiography, and I burned through it, and the parallels just kept hitting me like over the head. And that's when I became sort of a bit of a disciple for this this guy who, like you said, is not there in the in sort of the big, panoply of heroes that we hold up, the Hap Arnolds and the Jimmy Doolittles, but he is one of the, if not the most important guy. And
so we'll talk about other reasons. This past spring, when we were in the pandemic lockdowns, I'm taught a course to my squadron, eight weeks, an hour each week on Air Force history. Something that I've been wanting to do for a long time, and I was home, so I went and did it. And as we were getting ready, or as I was putting my brief together, or the academics together for the founding of the Air Force block of instruction, I just put a totally unscientific Twitter poll out there to air-minded Twitter. Who is the father, who should be considered the father of the United States Air Force? Billy Mitchell, Hap Arnold, or Benny Folloy? And 0% for Benny Folloy. Now, somebody did in the comments say he should be thought of as the grandfather of the Air Force and Hap Arnold as the father. And I said, okay, that at least somebody has known a little bit about his legacy. But the fact that, especially with one of his contemporaries, Billy Mitchell, and we'll get into that, that he is just completely forgotten, I think is a little bit almost criminal of us as airmen. So I'm happy that through you and through Amanda, I was able to learn about him. So let's start. He is the first military aviator. I mean, the first military aviator. He, I think, signed for whatever they called it, Airship One, or the first aircraft.
Signal Corps number one. Yep.
Yeah. So why don't you take us through who Benny Folloy was, and how he, first off, his book, I love the name of it, From the Wright Brothers to the Astronauts, totally true. During his lifetime, he trained under the Wright Brothers and then gets to see astronauts, I think passed away right before we put somebody on the moon. So who was Benny Folloy? How did he become the first military aviator?
Yeah, so I will try not to recap the entire career and summarize the entire book for you, but I'll start by saying, what you keyed in on were all these firsts, but the important thing is, why was he the first? And I would offer that he was the first because he actually thought about this stuff before anyone else, meaning when he was a Signal Corps officer. And oh, by the way, there's a good chunk of the book that recounts his time before he even became a Signal Corps officer, right? He started and he just said he didn't realize this at the time, he fraudulently enlisted in the U.S. Navy using his brother's birth certificate because he was too young, did a stint in Puerto Rico as an engineer, and then left service and rejoined, this time the Army, and was part of the Philippine insurrection, a campaign out there. Battlefield promoted to lieutenant and then came back to the States. But it was when he was a young officer thinking and writing about aviation because of his interest. He saw what was happening both with the lighter aircraft balloons and then dirigibles. And he had heard about these guys called the Wrights who were developing this thing called the aeroplane. And before he had seen one physically in the flesh, before he had really learned anything more than what was reported in the news about these two brothers in Ohio, he was already writing about the potential military applications and the applications to the Army Air Corps. And he actually predicted the end of horses and cavalry. He predicted the demise of the balloon and the dirigible. And of course, was right away branded as a whack job before he'd even met the Wrights or seen an airplane. And so this sort of prescience and the fact that he was willing to put it on paper, I think is what got him to the point where when Signal Corps Number 1 was actually delivered by the Wrights in 1909, after they met the terms of the contract, that we can get to him being a part of that, logic said, okay, you're the guy. You're the guy that we're going to give this thing to, this aeroplane that we just purchased, to figure out what the heck to do with it. And so before even setting seat in that wicker basket next to Wilbur, he's already thinking and writing about this. And so that's, if I could, for a minute, this is the kind of the first time we'll talk, I think, about true innovation. And I need to say here that a lot of people talk about innovation.
And it's so hot right now. Everybody wants to talk
about innovation. And to me, my frustration is a lot of people talk about innovation, and a lot of people are doing what I call innovation theater, right? You get a room, you put a 3D printer in there, you paint the walls bright, you put some beanbags in there, maybe an espresso machine. Oh, you're innovating.
You missed post-it notes, right? So that you can all write on post-it notes and then do the little word cloud. Yep, you're being innovative.
Graduate level innovation, if you rent a loft apartment in a downtown city, then you are truly innovating, right? Only if you have exposed brick walls and high loft ceilings are you really innovating. But that's innovation theater. What Benny did was what I call ask the big three questions. And these are the questions that I entreat all of my airmen to ask. All day, every day. Why not, and what if? And if you ask those three questions all day, every day, at every level, an organization that has people feeling empowered to ask those questions, innovation is going to happen. And Benny starts his book, actually, by talking about it as a child running around the woods, and he asks, why he sees birds flying around, he goes, why can't man fly? And so the guy's asking the first of the critical big three questions as a 12-year-old kid. And so that's, you want to talk origin stories, there you go. Big three questions, inquisitive mind, age 12. And all that turned into him ending up being the guy that's joined up with Wilbur Wright to sit there as a passenger observer in the right seat of what was then the 1907 Wright Flyer that they had modified slightly. Did the trials at Fort Myer, Virginia, and this was all in search of that big fat $40,000 contract to deliver a heavier than aircraft that could meet the specifications of 40 miles an hour and I can't remember 150 feet of altitude and you know X number of laps around a closed circuit, how many minutes in flight. But he did, and there was a number of others, of course, you know, Frank Lamb, I think Selfridge, Humphreys, a couple other lieutenants that were in that mix, but it was in fact Benny, who was the guy that was in that seat with Orville when they met the specs and handed over Signal Corps Number 1 to the Army.
So you already started hitting on many of my questions. One of the ones that I was going to get into is, what did he see that made him understand the military application of a heavier-than-air airship so much before everybody else? And then that kind of leads into a question that we'll get to later, is why is he not credited with that, with Billy Mitchell being credited as the big thinker that made us understand the military application of the aircraft? So I guess, you know, you kind of hit on it a little bit, but besides the inquisitive mind, how did he come to the conclusion that this, and did he understand the extent to which error would change military operations?
I would love to say that I know. I only wish that I could have been there at the time to ask. But as he recounts in his book and as other history reveals, all we have is what he wrote and then what he said in his autobiography. But clearly in his papers, and he wrote this as part of his staff college time, or his I guess the equivalent of the CGO type school time, was in fact very prescient. He said that this has and will have application for reconnaissance, in essence, for air-to-ground photography. And the other thing, and I think this is his roots as a Signal Corps officer, he was all about wireless telegraphy, right? He understood that just because this thing was not fixed to a pole or to a position, you could communicate with it. And I thought really the fascinating thing is, before he even learned how to fly, before he had taken delivery, but he had yet to crate it up and take it to San Antonio, before they took it down there, and hopefully we'll get to those awesome mission type orders that I have emblazoned everywhere, he was told, you got to go and kind of market this thing. And so he did a stop on the way to an electronics show. And I think, I can't remember if it was in Ohio or something. It was the 1909 equivalent of the Consumer Electronics Show in Las Vegas. Right? It was sort of the biggest trade show in the country.
Probably not the same nightlife.
Probably not. But the idea was exactly the same. They took this Signal Corps number one, they disassembled it, brought it out there, and then they reassembled it and literally hung it from the rafters. And his job was to basically kind of just show this thing off, right? Because the Army and the U.S. government were up with the times, and they got all this cool new technology. And so what I found fascinating is that he actually not only hung it from the ceiling, put little electric motors on it to spin the props for theatrics, but he already had put a wireless telegraph box in the airplane and was demonstrating the fact that, yeah, see, I can talk to it and it to me, and here's an application. Before he even learned how to fly, he's already thinking about, you know, seeing it from the air, in essence, which is pretty damn cool, in my opinion.
So you hit it on it. He eventually takes the aircraft down to Texas. He eventually commands the first Aero Squadron. And the first combat employment, such as it was in the Mexican-American. So General Pershing is tasked to go hunt down Pancho Villa, and the 1st Aero Squadron is in support. A lot of lessons learned. I wouldn't say it was very successful in terms of the employment of the aircraft, but there were some valuable lessons learned in terms of what they were able to do successfully and not. What are some of the things that you thought that Benny was able to learn from the time in support of General Pershing in that campaign, I should at least say?
So if I could, before we get to the punitive expedition in Mexico, I got to say, because we skip over a critical piece here, and that's back to the whole roots of innovation, right? The orders that he received to take Singapore number one down to Fort Sam Houston in San Antonio to start this whole crazy thing, this adventure, were some of the most, I think, beautiful mission type orders ever written. And it was the Army Signal Corps chief at the time, General Allen, who gave him his orders. And they were simply this: teach yourself to fly and bring along plenty of spare parts. I mean, that was it. I mean, it doesn't get better than that, right? Just go down there, teach yourself to fly. And this is where the true innovation starts. Again, innovation doesn't have to be groundbreaking, earth-shattering, record-setting right away. The guy had literally never flown an airplane by himself. He had 53 minutes, I think, of passenger time next to Orville Wright total. But he'd never taken off, never landed. The first time he took that thing off was the first time he'd ever actually manipulated the controls. And then he did this all by correspondence. Like, he would fly, crash, it was rough, and then he would buy, telegram, correspond with Orville Wright, going, hey, on Wilbur, here's what I did, what I do wrong, how do I do it better tomorrow morning? So he was really the first correspondence student too. But all that was happening with one airplane. And for example, he would get thrown out of the airplane every time he landed because it had skids, it was rough.
Yep.
He was like, no, this hurts. I don't want to do this anymore. So he had one of his team snag a saddle strap from the cavalry barn that they had set up there on the next to the parade field. And he made himself a seatbelt. Nobody told him to do it. Nobody gave him the specs. Nobody checked him out. He just did it. And then he's like, yeah, these skids, they kind of suck. How about we put wheels on? And so he goes and he grabs some wheels off a threshing machine, in the field next there. And the next day, the thing's got wheels. And it's these little things, just constant innovation. And then in, less than 4 short years, he goes from Signal Corps number 1 to a squadron of Curtis JN4 Jennies, moving to New Mexico to chase Pancho Villa around.
So before we get into that, this is hearing the passion that you talk about, Benny Floyd, and the tying it to innovation, which was going to be one of my questions, and why you bring him up so much in innovation is awesome. This is exactly why I brought you on here to talk about those innovation, big and small, and why you really talk about him with innovation. So sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt you. I just was excited to hear you get excited about Benny Floyd.
Yeah, no, it's definitely a theme that you can't shake. Once you read it, once you see it, it becomes so obvious that you can't help but notice it in all these historic parallels, right? Because they tend to repeat if we let them. Anywho, so yeah, he takes this very small squadron. I think it was six or eight aircraft, and talk about mission type orders. You thought teach yourself to fly and bring along plenty of spare parts was awesome, broad but concise sort of mission type orders. I do you one better. His orders to leave San Antonio and go to New Mexico to support Pershing in this thing, it was a one-word order, and that word was proceed. I mean, it doesn't get better than that, right? I mean, here's your order, proceed. Just go do it, Airman. How have we come so far and then strayed so far from that, right, in the 107 years? Anyway, so proceed. And that's what he does. He proceeds. And the orders to Pershing was to, quote, make all practical use of the aeroplane at San Antonio for observation. And so that's what he did. You're right. They wasn't a wildly successful operation. In fact, Benny Floyd, among his firsts, became the first POW. He had engine problems over Mexico while they were searching for Pancho Villa, mapping it out. And he had a rough landing and had to talk his way out of a Mexican jail after standing down an angry Mexican mob who was not ready to tear up his airplane.
And now we'll take a short break from the interview as my 17-month-old son, Tyson Jr., took over the microphone for just a couple of seconds.
Oh, can you say hi?
Bye! Bye. Well, that was a short conversation.
And now back to the interview.
Some observation successes, some even just bringing the mail were some of the successes. So learned some good lessons. Probably wouldn't expect that they would be in combat in Europe just a few years later, where Floyd, for at least a time, led the Air Expeditionary Air Forces. I guess from the World War I perspective, what was Floyd's role in World War I? And then this is kind of when Billy Mitchell joins our story. And that will kind of lead into my question about the comparing the two and who we should give or how we should divvy up credit for these early days and these successes and learning about air power employment.
Yeah, so you're exactly right. This is where, at least in his autobiography, Benny begins to talk pretty specifically about Billy Mitchell and the relationship. And it wasn't a good one. Period. They were very antagonistic. And it's kind of interesting, as a dispassionate observer of history, that human beings are human beings. And there are some that you're going to get along with and others that just get under your skin. And clearly those two, oil and water. They fought their entire career. And I fully appreciate that there are at least six sides to every story, not just two. But in Floyd's autobiography, as he recounts it, he was there, he followed. He was there from the beginning, as we just talked through. And Billy Mitchell was pretty dismissive in the very early days. He was among Floyd's detractors, that is, calling him, you know, far too, I guess, giving the aircraft far too much credit and thinking that it was going to do more than it could or should, and that Billy Mitchell really didn't become an air power advocate until 1916 as an older officer versus, you know, Floyd from the beginning. Again, Benny's son. But the fact of the matter is that Billy Mitchell was a very, very aggressive, dynamic personality who made a lot of enemies, clearly passionate, clearly much more of the showman. He used the media, he used the political institution to advance the cause of air power. But when it came to the two of them, there was distrust and I think the assumption of ill will on both sides. And so Billy Mitchell was over there and Benny was sent there in essence, as he recounts it, to straighten things out and get America ready logistically, organizationally to support the French in the air. And that's where the friction really started, was in the idea of who was going to be running the show in the American Expeditionary Forces.
And so Billy Mitchell had been there, was developing a relationship with Pershing, who also had a relationship with Floyd. Boy, you read both, you know, their perspectives, and they are kind of 180 out about who should get the credit. And I guess, you know, I'm not looking to adjudicate that question. The question that I have is, why is it that Floyd doesn't get any credit, where Mitchell gets all of the credit? Is it the court-martial of Billy Mitchell and the fact that he was just kind of a bombastic personality that he is remembered? Whereas kind of one way I look at it is that Mitchell was willing to kind of burn the system down, where Floyd was kind of a system guy. He worked within the system to try and advance the cause of air power. So who had the most effect? It is really tough to say. But what is your kind of perspective on maybe how we should look at Floyd and his contributions kind of vis-a-vis Billy Mitchell?
Yeah, it's a great question, and it's really a fundamental one because it speaks to how we consume information today and how people consumed information back then. And I think it was exactly the same. If you look at it from the perspective of the media, right, if it bleeds, it leads. It's got to be interesting, exciting. Everything has to be breaking news. And Billy Mitchell did that. He did that for the newspapers. He did it for the pundits. He was, as you say, bombastic. He was dramatic. He was hyperbolic, and that was effective. Billy was that guy. He was the showman, and Benny was the quiet, behind the scenes, deliberate, procedural. Not that he didn't do interesting things. I mean, in the book, he recounts how he, you know, he treated the good graces of young secretaries of congressmen and set up poker nights so that he could get the ear of the important people to make the case for money. But he did stay out of the media. He stayed out of the limelight. He was absolutely behind the scenes. And I think that has to have contributed to the sort of collective body of writing and reporting about both individuals. And clearly, Billy Mitchell got the lion's share of that. And just like today, the news doesn't work if it's boring. It doesn't work if there's simply rational explanation of fact. It works when there's drama and hyperbole and explosions in the background and bright colored screens and people pitted against each other. And I'm sure it happened exactly the same way in 1920, in 1929. A lot of things are no different.
So one of the questions I was planning on ending with, but since we're talking about it now, so that's certainly why I think Mitchell is remembered. But as a service, any idea why you think the Air Force has not, like, maybe come back around on Floyd, or it's not something that's pushed in professional military education in the Air Force? if it has, it's certainly nothing that ever made enough of an impact on me that I remember discussing him. Now, I didn't go to Air Command and Staff or Air War College, but any thoughts on why big Air Force hasn't come back on Feloy as somebody that we need to be studying or thinking of as one of the pioneers, the absolute pioneers of our service?
So, Grilla, I don't have a good answer for you. I truly do not know. Because after, if everyone reads the same book I read, and it's even 80%, then, yeah, it begs the question, what are we missing here? Because it's fascinating. You read his book of the people he taught to fly, or that he flew with, that he worked with, that he enabled. These are all people in his book that we have Air Force bases named after. Right? Hickam, Arnold, Lowry, Patrick, Mitchell and Doolittle, no basis. But these are all names we know. Yet his own name, the guy who puts this all down in the history, is not on an Air Force base. It's not on a sign. Maybe it's on a street somewhere. But you're right, we don't. And I truly do not have an answer why. Other than he was behind the scenes.
He was behind the scenes. We'll talk about it. I mean, he led the Air Corps for a while. But I know you certainly have been, you talk about him in speeches. When you were commander of the 70th Intelligence, Surveillance, and Reconnaissance Wing, you named the wing's Innovation Center, the Benny Feloy Center. So I know you're still talking. I think I read the same book that you did, or at least it affected me in the same way, and that it's one that I've given out. I know you continue to give them out. I always look for the book wherever I can find it and continue to push it. I think it's really important. What I haven't heard anybody do is link innovation to Benny Feloy the way that you do. It makes a lot of sense. The way that he was innovating both large and small. And so, that's partly why I wanted to have you on here is if a few people learn a little bit about Benny Feloy and can find a copy of From the Wright Brothers to the Astronauts. Not easy to find anymore, but find it, read it. I think they're going to have the same kind of thought that we have. And hopefully, you kind of build that up a little bit. So he continues to work in the background. Mitchell kind of, if you will, lights himself on fire by going one step too far, gets court-martialed, eventually leaves the service. Benny Feloy just continues to progress, eventually from 31 to 35. He is chief of the Air Corps during this time, the airmail fiasco. I don't know if that is, a stain on his legacy and that's what kind of holds him back. But and maybe it's partly because he leaves the service before World War II. But what kind of legacy? So we're talking about the first military aviator. You've talked about his legacy with innovation. What kind of innovation do you think he left in terms of the employment of air power in World War II and beyond? What should we think of him? Like I mentioned, I consider him maybe the father or the grandfather of the Air Force. What do you think is his enduring legacy or should be his enduring legacy? Is it innovation or is it something else?
So when I talk about Benny in the context of innovation, and I do because I said the parallels are striking in many ways, I really talk about those early years because to me that is where it's most obvious. And perhaps you can't help but be innovative when you're at the birth of a new domain or new function, new capability, because by definition, everything is new. And so you get credit for everything being innovation. But maybe that's a cop-out. He didn't have to do the things he did. He could have just taken signal corps number one and taught himself to fly, and that was good enough. But it's amazing when you think about the timing, the time frames we're talking about. And this is something that I share with all my airmen, anyone who will listen. When you think that you need, number one, that you need to do something big and dramatic, right? You don't. You just need to constantly ask the big three questions and then make micro innovations and drive, because that is how things advance over time. But if you just think about Benny Feloy's career, or at least the first half, think about it this way. From 1909, when he first sat in that wicker seat, to 1911, 12, during the punitive expeditions. That's 3 years, 4 years. That's one assignment cycle. And in one assignment cycle, when you and I would PCS somewhere, do a job and then leave, the guy goes from a single airplane, eight guys, and beautiful mission type orders. Teach yourself to fly, bring plane make spare parts. He goes from that to a squadron of airplanes that are wildly different than the one that he started with. And he's already integrating air ground, doing support to operations in our ostensibly combat theater, Mexico. Just a few short years later, he is commanding American expeditionary forces in Europe. Hundreds of squadrons, thousands of, not dozens of squadrons, hundreds of airplanes, thousands of guys. And so that's just in maybe two assignment cycles. The pace and the speed was just staggering. You read in the book about how he would bounce around across the country from one place to another doing things. This is in the days of trains and horses and carriages still, right? And he's going to San Diego, California, setting up a school right here in College Park, Maryland, the oldest continuously operating airfield, by the way, right here in our own backyard. People have not been there. It's worth an afternoon. They got a great little museum, and you can stand on the grass field, the longest continuously operating airfield in the world, frankly, because this is where he set it up with Signal Corps numbers 2 through whatever, and taught half hour about flying. He's doing all this in one assignment cycle, right? In a few years. He spent his own money on stuff because the government wasn't keeping pace with his vision and the advancing technology. These are the kind of things that I, frankly, hopefully none of our airmen are spending too much of their own money on this stuff, but these parallels are happening today, whether we, you know, are talking about DIU, Kessel Run, Project Maven, or any of the homegrown things that our airmen are doing in their respective squadrons and groups and wings of 16th Air Force and beyond. That's the legacy right there. It's a young lieutenant, captain, with eight enlisted folks who, by the way, ought not be left out of this picture, right? We haven't talked about Vernon Burge, the first enlisted aviator, who was right there with him in the dirigibles and then in the heavier the air flight. Fascinating partnership there with the pilots and the mechanics. The true officer enlisted team that we as commanders, and I know you do, we hold so dear and important. That leadership team, the officer enlisted team, what started with Benny, Vernon, and a handful of others. Those are the kind of things to me that were innovative before the buzzword of innovation became cool.
So I did want to talk a little bit about innovation. I love your phrase, the innovation theater. There is some great innovation going on in the Air Force, the Space Force, and throughout the truly the joint community. There is also a lot of talk about innovation. So what do you think, you've mentioned the innovation theater, what are things that we're failing at? What are maybe areas where kind of DOD is not hitting the mark? One of the things I'll tell you kind of what I see is we're trying to be a little bit too rigid in terms of kind of pigeonholing certain things in innovation. You must do this or that. And I don't think that's how innovation springs up. So where are areas that you think we're failing in innovation, or at least areas that could be improved?
So I think a lot of where we get hung up is in the application of the existing tribal, call it tribal or bureaucratic legacy structures that we try to impose on what we call innovation, right? So if you give a couple tech sergeants, staff sergeants, and captains the kind of direction that Benny was given, right? Go figure something out. Just go make it happen. Like we used to call them evil genius meetings when I was in the 315th Network Warfare Squad. We would devote time on Friday, and I don't get claim credit for evil genius meetings. Those are actually my predecessor. Initiated those, but we kept them going. Every Friday afternoon, you would just lock in time and you put the smart folks in a room and say, just go think evil thoughts and come up with bad stuff to do to bad guys in cyberspace domain. And they would just come up with these things that you couldn't have come up with if you typed orders and said, do this, right? You just, instead, you say, go think of what we might be able to do. Why can't we get away with X, Y, or Z? And then that turns into some really cool things. But what happens, and it's not anybody's fault, it's the institution, it's large, it has history, it's got tribes, it's got paths to get things done. So once you go from the good ideas to the implementation, it necessarily falls into various bins and tribes, and that's where things get hung up. So the short answer is we've got to crack the code on the translation of the good ideas, the answers to the why not, and what if. We've got to crack the code of the implementation. In some cases, we've been successful in doing that. We really have. I've used DIU as an example, some Kessel Run, but that's sort of the easy answer, right? You have a few examples like that. Hey, that worked. Go do more of that. To me, the exciting stuff is when you look at 110 years later, we're circles around again. We're doing what Benny was doing. You know, why does the Compass Call have to be an EW platform? Why does the F-16 have to be only a fighter and only on the ATO? And why do we have certain platforms on our RISTA? Right? Your audience who doesn't know, reconnaissance targeting annex, these are ISR platforms, these are strike platforms. Never the twain shall meet, and heaven forbid we actually ask a fighter or an EW platform to also throw some Trons. Or heaven forbid we take a EW asset, electronic warfare asset, and ask it to multitask at the same time doing some cool RF injection, perhaps. These things are all possible. They've happened. We've done them before, but there's institutional inertia for lots of good reason. But to me, the biggest struggle is overcoming those because there are plenty of good ideas out there.
I take a moment to pause there. We both work very closely with the National Security Agency, which talk about some opposition to some inertia. That is one area. But I did want to talk a little bit. I mean, you are clearly very passionate about our history. I guess one other thing that I was going to point out just on innovation, and you talked about it in your Evil Genius meetings, I think allowing the white space, the big thinkers to have some time to think. And I think it's really across the organization. I also think as leaders, we do not often block an hour of big think time on our calendars. And I think that's probably a failure. It's something that I said that I was going to do, and I did in the first few months. And, you know, COVID happens, and pretty soon that gets impinged upon. But I don't think we, throughout the chain, either give our people enough time to do big think and do big think ourselves.
That's a fantastic point. And it's something that I tell all of my leaders at every level, and it applies to everyone, not just leaders in official leadership positions. Some of the best advice I've ever been given. I can't even remember who gave it to me, but I remember it and I use it all the time. And that is, only do that which only you can do. Yeah. Right? If I'm the director of intelligence right now, right, for Cyber Command, I should not be doing analysis and reading the traffic and fusing all source intelligence to produce a presentation to give to my boss, General Huxley. That's what I have analysts to do, and they are fantastic at it. Why would I think that I could do something that they are exactly in their sweet spot in their career, in their tradecraft to do? Because if I'm doing that, number one, I'm denying them the opportunity to do their job and to grow and to learn, et cetera. But more importantly, I am not doing the one thing or the five things or the 10 things that only I can do that they can't. So they may not be as excited. They may not be as sexy. But there are things that I, as a director of intelligence, and only I can do. Mm-hmm. And I have to focus on those. And if you are a squadron commander, you should only do the things that only a squadron commander can do, and let your DO do the things that the DO can do, and let your flight commander do the flight commander things, and the SOOP do the SOOP things. And so very often in our collective careers, as we graduate and move on in leadership positions, we forget to learn those things that only we can do. And that's our value to the organization. And so only do that which only you can do is valuable advice at every level, to include the brand new airman. Because one of the things that their job is to do is ask those big three questions with the new fresh eyes and go, why do we do things this way? You know, what? Why can't I do it this way? Oh, geez, you know what? I don't know. And if I can't give you a good answer, maybe we should try.
I love the big three questions. All right, I wanted to transition before I let you go. Talking a little bit about being a professional in the profession of arms, and really in particular, since we're talking air-minded, you got clearly a passion for it and a background. This also happens to be National Reading Month. I'm giving a professional development to my unit next week on professional reading. I just saw it today. General Brown released his, you can't even really call it a reading list anymore. It's a living document. I don't know if you've seen that he just put out. It's podcasts, it's videos, it's books that he's constantly changing. It's more a reading dashboard, if you will, kind of a leadership resource location. I thought it was a cool way of looking at the traditional reading list. So you are talking to an air-minded crowd. What would you recommend folks that are interested in learning more, being a better professional in the, not just a profession of arms, but really in terms of air power employment, history, theory? What are some things that we should either be reading or be thinking about, or kind of what's the future? Are there things that you would give those air-minded listeners out there, kind of your guidance on where we should be going and thinking?
Ooh.
It's a big one. I know, and I didn't prepare you for that one. Sorry.
Thank you at least for saying that that you didn't prepare me, because I am absolutely now on the spot. And gosh, I don't like to be prescriptive about a book or books because I feel like then people are like, well, if I read that, I'm good. You should read what is interesting to you or what you think might be interesting. I would actually say, unlike a lot of my engineering friends who give me grief about this all the time, I'm a proud liberal arts major. International politics degree, I barely can do long division anymore. I've had to learn how to spell TCP, IP, and get a little technical in the latter half of my career just to keep up with the amazing airmen that I get the privilege to lead. But I still default to the kind of reading that has nothing to do with the business of either intelligence or cyberspace operations or air power, because I find the power in the connections to things that I would have never thought existed, right? And so maybe it's, you know, it's kind of a cheesy, you know, cop-out, but it's this whole idea of the Renaissance approach to learning. It's read a little bit of everything, and then these things reveal themselves to you. I was gifted a great little book. I think it was a message. I don't know. When I left JTF-OIR this summer, the deputy commander gave me a book, and I forget the name of the author, called Ego is the Enemy. And it's one of these sort of airport self-help books you could kind of label as that. It's, that's pejorative. That's not fair. But very short little book. And I'm not big on these sort of, you know, how to make yourself a better person kind of books, but it was a great little reminder. And it's called Ego is the Enemy. And it basically makes the case that the further you go, the more powerful you become, the more you can fall into the trap of believing your own myth. And my gosh, if that's not true, if we haven't seen that in our senior leaders at every level, right? Those who get in trouble are the ones who forget the trait of humility and who begin to believe their own myth, you know, none of us actually get more handsome as we achieve rank. None of us actually get more funny, yet people laugh at our jokes. People will fawn over us as if we have become more beautiful or more handsome. And we're simply not. It's positional power. And those who get in trouble, those who forget to do only that which only they can do, are the ones who become enamored with that piece of the benefits of leadership and power, etc. So this little book was a reminder to stay humble, and the further you go, the more humility you need. And it has nothing to do with animation, nothing to do with air power, but since you put me on the spot, it happens to be one of the last books that I have on the old bookshelf here.
Well, that was going to be one of a recent book. That was going to be another question, was a recent book. So that works. Now you, for me at least, shed some light on Benny Folloy a few years ago when I read this book. Anything else that you are hiding? Any other air power practitioners, theorists, anything that you don't think is getting enough kind of run in Air Force channels that maybe we should take a look at, or I should think about talking about on this platform?
I don't want to overload, and that's a cop out. I truly don't have anything off the top of my head. You are probably far better read than I, and I think you're doing a great job with the podcast covering on a lot of the stuff. So no is the short answer. This was enough for your listeners to chew on. But I'll tell you, if I could, just kind of one more plea, and this is tying history to today, right? And this idea that innovation is not the domain of the Silicon Valley hipsters. It is not something for others. It's ours to own, and we got to make sure it doesn't just become or stay a buzzword. And history has so many cool lessons to teach us that we're not that different. Things are not any worse. In fact, they repeat themselves. And if you look at the story of Benny Folloy, we talked about what happened in one PCS time frame, right? 1 2 to 4 year period, maybe five for some. But if you look at one lifetime, and this is what's exciting, this guy in one lifetime went, just 110 years ago, went from sitting in a wicker seat in a fabric airplane going 40 miles an hour with Orville Wright, wood and fabric, to seeing the SR-71 fly, like all titanium, 2,500 miles an hour, Mach 3, 70,000 feet. No, Wright Flyer, SR-71, in one lifetime. And this domain of cyberspace and the convergence of EW, ISR, and cyberspace ops, it is exactly where we were 110 years ago in that new domain called the air, with this thing called the aeroplane that nobody really understood, but they gave it to one guy and said, teach yourself to fly. Bring on any spare parts, don't hurt yourself. We're kind of there. And as airmen, we ought to own this, and we ought to own it with the same kind of passion. Some of us are going to be the Billy Mitchells, right? The approach of the flamboyant and the attracting attention and the dramatic, which is important and necessarily worked. And some of us are going to be that quiet, behind the scenes bureaucrat, fighting for every dollar, arguing for every logistical, hurdle. And together, you're going to end up, I don't know where we're going to end up, but it's pretty damn exciting when you think about where in our careers we're going to see these kind of operations. What's going to be our SR-71 when we're 85 years old and looking back on a career? And if that doesn't inspire you, I don't know what does.
Well, I am inspired. I believe the listeners will be, and I think you're going to be responsible for moving at least a few of the remaining copies of Folloy's autobiography, which I think is a good thing.
Don't read them online. Don't take them, because I need to buy more, because I have no farewell gifts left. So if anybody has any extra copies, send them my way. I will pay you handsomely.
I have one from my library, and I have one that I am waiting to give away. So, and demand is increasing the price of those things. It is not easy to buy them in bulk like we maybe were able to a few years ago. Well, General Martimucci, I really appreciate it. It was exactly what I was looking for, an opportunity not only to talk about Benny Folloy, but also why you link him to innovation and talk so eloquently about it. And it transitioned into the conversation about innovation, which is where I thought this conversation would lead to. So I really appreciate you coming on. I might have to have you on again. Maybe we can do it in person some point. I just saw your the pizza maker that you have in the backyard on Facebook. So next time we do this in person, you might have to make me a pizza.
Weather's getting nice. The pizza oven will be on regularly. As long as that microphone of yours can travel, I'm happy to do it anytime.
All right. Sounds awesome. Thank you, sir.
Have a great night.
All right. Well, that does it for my interview with Brigadier General Martimucci. Big thanks to the general for joining me. I really enjoyed hearing about him talk about Benny Folloy and a culture of innovation. It clearly gets him going, and it's hard not to be inspired and want to be innovative when you have a leader like that, that talks about innovation the way he does and the way that he ties it to General Floyd, I think is awesome. Sorry about the audio quality during General Martimucci's answers. I was tinkering with it as he was going along. Wasn't sure what the problem was. So not great audio. That's my mistake. I hope you all enjoyed learning a little bit about the grandfather of the U.S. Air Force, at least as I call him, General Benny Folloy. I hope some of you pick up the book From the Wright Brothers to the Astronauts. I think you'll really enjoy it. Thanks to those of you who sent direct messages, emails, and social media posts with recommendations, feedback. I really appreciate it. Keep them coming. You can reach me at airmindedpodcast@gmail.com. I'm also active on social media as @airmindedpod on Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, and LinkedIn. And as a reminder, the views and opinions expressed in this episode are mine and General Martimucci's and do not necessarily reflect the official policy or position of the Department of Defense or the United States Air Force. Thanks again for tuning in, and this is the Air-Minded Guerrilla, Tyson Wetzel, signing off until next time.